Grace Simons stands tall in every aspect that makes a great athlete and a great wrestler and a great person. Grace Simons will always be one of the all-time greats.
He dominated everybody. He won every national tournament he was in. Won 4 NAIA championships, 3 NCAA championships. He'd have been a four-timer had he been eligible. There was nobody could stay with him.
He was known to be the best 118-pounder in the country. And there was no one else to match him to make two Olympic teams. He could have made a third Olympic team, but he decided he did not want to give up his time with his team.
I'd work out with him anytime I could, and of course he could beat anybody from his weight all the way through heavyweight.
Gray took wrestling to another level. The greatest wrestlers, you would teach them one hold, and they would come back and show you 10 different ways to do that one hold. They would be innovators.
I would not go on the mat unless he was in my corner.
He'd be patient, and then all of a sudden, you're taken down, and you're down, and you're on your back. That's how great it was in practice. And then he would laugh.
I'm Jason Bryant, and from the National Wrestling Hall of Fame's Etched in Stone series, this is 7, the story of Olympian Gray Simons, college wrestling's only 7-time national champion. Born August 13, 1939 in Norfolk, Virginia, Elliot Gray Simons became a generational icon in the sport of wrestling. Breaking out in the 1950s and becoming college wrestling's first 4-time national champion. There's also something unique about Gray Simons. He's rarely referenced by this generation's fans and media, or even their parents. Simons' 4 NAIA titles at what was then known as Lock Haven State Teachers College isn't just some small school legend. His senior season in 1962, Gray won that 4th NAIA championship, becoming the first wrestler to do so, but he also won his 3rd NCAA title. So in setting off to tell the story about Gray Simons, it isn't just about showing the backstory and what made him tick. Rather, this becomes a masterclass for the sport to rediscover this humble hero who set records and, by numerous metrics, raised the bar for American collegiate wrestling. In the years before YouTube, Flow Wrestling, and the internet in general, the lore of wrestlers was through the pages of amateur wrestling news and on television and ABC's Wide World of Sports, and through the stories of those who witnessed firsthand these dominant performances. So to really understand the greatness of Gray Simons, you do have to go back to the beginning and his foundations at one of the sport's first high school dynasties, the legendary Granby High School, and its legendary coach, Billy Martin.
I'm Wayne Martin. I'm my current position, I'm the Director of Student Support Services for Chesapeake Public Schools.
Wayne is the third oldest son of Billy Martin Sr. Wayne's also the de facto historian of all things Granby and all things Martin.
So I have quite a few tasks in my current position. My relationship with Gray Simons is that, of course, obviously he wrestled at Granby High School. He was coached by my father, Billy Martin Sr., and so Gray was one of the many legends that came out of Granby Wrestling. Dad won 21 out of 22 state championships. They were second one year. He mentored, I think he had 78 wrestlers who won a total of about 108 individual Virginia High School League state championships.
But before Gray Simons ever became one of the best wrestlers America's ever seen, he first had to discover the sport, and he did so through Coach Martin. Here's Gray Simons explaining how he ended up wrestling at Granby High School.
There was no middle school at that time. First through seventh grade and eighth grade, you went to the high school. There was no middle school. And I went in the middle of the year. I was born in August. I missed a half a semester of school due to a knee injury. So that put me in the middle. So you could go, I went from eighth grade in the middle of the year to Granby. So I got there, and part of the physical education program was wrestling. Bill Martin taught wrestling in the class, And then they had an intramural tournament, and I was in the 75-pound weight class, and I got second, but there are only two guys in the weight.
But Billy Martin Sr. was dynamic in terms of he knew how to find the wrestlers that he would encourage to enter the intramural tournament. Wayne explains how his dad got so many young men introduced to the sport of wrestling.
There was a great, great area that had a lot of great athletes, and that was the Ocean View area. Ocean View at that point in time was zoned to Granby High School. It's kind of broken up now between Granby and Norview. And so dad got a lot of great athletes from that Ocean View area, and they all went to Northside Middle School. And there was also two elementary schools that fed Northside Middle School. So what dad would do, now he taught physical health and physical education. So he made sure that he always had a PE. It was like a field day, and he would do it at Northside, and he'd also do it at those two elementary feeder schools. He would go there, he got permission to go, and he'd do like, you know, a strength, and you know, they had competitions. I'm not sure what all the competitions were, but one of the things was pull-ups. You know, how many pull-ups could you do? And you would enter your kids, I guess, if you're a teacher, you had a kid that wanted to enter. So he would always be, he would kind of monitor the kids that were real strong, could run quickly, and do a lot of push-ups, and identify them when they were in the elementary school. And then when they got to Northside Middle School, he would come down to Northside and he would do the same thing. And at that point in time, they were kind of starting some middle school athletics. And now this was a little bit later on towards the end of his career. But he knew, he pretty much by going around as a physical education teacher, he knew the kids that were going to be really good athletes. He had a great eye at looking at kids that had great balance, strength, and endurance. And then, you know, he would, and luckily a lot of them came from that Ocean View era. They lived in the Ocean View area and Bay Street and all that kind of stuff going out towards Ocean View. And so when he got those first teams going, he would ask some of them, a lot of his wrestlers had brothers, you know, and then they had friends. And he'd find out for the brothers and their friends who were the great best athletes. And he'd have his wrestlers talk to those kids. Hey, when you get a little bit older, we'll start showing you how to wrestle a little bit more, and you can be a part of the team maybe at Granby High School if you're good enough.
When Wayne explains about the number of athletes that came from those Ocean View neighborhoods, he wasn't exaggerating. Here's Gray explaining just his street alone.
On Chesapeake Boulevard, within a couple of blocks of each other, next door lived the Piercy brothers. Ernie was the oldest. He was, he'd graduate at the time I got to Granby. He was a two-time state champ. I think he went to Tech. And then his brother David was a couple years ahead of me. He won the nationals, states 1 year. Down the street was Brandon Glover, and he won the states. And Brandon went to Tech. He was Tech's first All-American. And then his younger brother was a state champ. Of course, my younger brother, Wayne, he was a four-time state champ. That area of Chesapeake Boulevard down at Ocean View was a wrestling haven for Granby High School.
Another early childhood friend is eventual NCAA champion Freddie Powell, who not only was a future Granby teammate, he was a future teammate at Lock Haven.
My name is Fred Powell, and I was born in Norfolk, Virginia, and I went to Granby High School. And from Granby, I went on to Lock Haven, and from there I went on to West Point coaching, and then went to graduate school. And then from there I went right to Slippery Rock University, and from there I started the high school program when I retired from coaching wrestling at Slippery Rock University. Now I'm assistant coach at Butler High School, where the head coach wrestled for me.
The lives of Fred Powell and Gray Simage would intersect multiple times, but Fred remembers the first time the two met, back in Norfolk.
10 years old. We lived on the same street in Norfolk. And then we played football and just snowballs, that type of thing, when it snowed in Norfolk. And then he moved on down to close to Virginia Beach. And from there, my very first year of wrestling was his senior year. And he was my student coach, you might say. Mr. Martin was the coach, and he said, Gray, you take over this guy, Fred Powell. And there were two guys, two lightweights. One was a Ronnie Rowe, who was just an outstanding athlete. He was a freshman. And he was being coached by Okla Johnson, who was a four-time state champ for Granby, who went on to Michigan State and wrestled for Michigan State.
One of the things that kept the Granby machine rolling in those eras was Coach Martin's insistence that his older wrestlers would teach the younger ones, as Fred explained. Here's how Gray Simon saw it.
And one of the things that he did, he'd have the whole group doing it, and then maybe he'd have two or three guys that were having problems. Well, he'd take his best guys and say, go over and help work with him, the older guys. As you well know, nothing reinforces it like teaching it. If you teach something, you reinforce it. So he had that idea of not only do you learn it and work it in a match, but then you teach it to somebody, and that reinforces it.
Here's Fred Powell.
It was a fantastic system that he, Mr. Martin did not wrestle with the guys like I did and Gray did when we were coaching. He would have a master of technique, and once the technique was taught, he taught it to each of his wrestlers, and each of those wrestlers would then teach other wrestlers the same technique that he had taught all of us. So we were a factory of coaches developed under his tutelage.
When the time came for competitions, Coach Martin's demeanor was a little different.
Yeah, you know, my father was kind of reserved when he coached. Matter of fact, he never hardly even said a word. What he had his manager seated right next to him, and his manager had a notebook. And as the competition was going on, he would tell the manager what to write down. These were the mistakes this wrestler was making, because we didn't have video back in those days when he first started at Granby in the late 40s and through the 50s. And so when Gray wrestled there, you know, he did the same thing. He had the manager, and that's how he corrected mistakes. He'd go back to the notebook. He'd bring the notebook to practice every day, and they'd correct the mistakes that they made on a Saturday night to get ready for the next Saturday night match.
Much of the success of Granby's wrestling system came from the methodical approach of Billy Martin.
It was good because there were other kids, people that were in the same boat I was in, not all my size, but, you know, a couple weights higher than me, that had come in that were new guys. And he paired them up, and you wrestle and stuff. One of the things, he would teach moves, you know, we switch, stand up, stuff like that. But he tried to go to the NCAAs every year and pick up stuff the best guys were doing.
Coaching, the reinforcement of technique, of course, coupled with identifying talent, made Granby a wrestling machine. But who was next? Was Gray Simons the next in line? To answer that question, you have to go back to Gray prior to ninth grade.
Other next gym class, the next semester, and work with me more in wrestling, he'd pick the guys he wanted. He thought he could help the best. And so I started, that's when I started wrestling and learning more and more and competing. And I made the team at 95, and I wrestled, I think I lost maybe two or three matches that year. I lost two to the same guy from Warwick. And then the guy weighed above me, Mike Grandstaff, he was defending champ at 95. So when the state meet came, there was no regional, no district, just the states in Charlottesville. Mike moved back down to 95. So I didn't wrestle in the state meet that my first year I was competing. Although they did take me up there so I could see it, which was a good thing for me. And Mike won the tournament his second year in a row. And then
from a developmental perspective, it was a pretty solid first year. Getting time in the lineup, only losing your spot out to the returning state champion, who would later win a second title. But the region of Norfolk, Ocean View, that provided all those stellar athletes, was also in the midst of redistricting, which opened the door for Gray Simons to start at Granby High School.
Mike lived further down on Chesapeake Boulevard, and they changed the zones. So the next year, Mike went to Norview. So my sophomore year, I won the states.
Surely you'd think this was the first of three straight state titles for Gray Simons. But Mike Grandstaff wasn't done yet.
And then my junior year, I got beat by Mike in the finals. And then I had another year left, but they changed the rule where if you start in the middle of the year, you had to finish your eligibility in the middle of the year. You couldn't, like, say I'm not competing and take that extra half a year.
But in Gray Simon's 4 years of wrestling, a Granby wrestler or former Granby wrestler, won his weight class each of those years. As a freshman, it was Mike Grandstaff. As a sophomore, it was Gray's state title. As a junior, Mike Grandstaff, now at Norview, won another state title. And in Gray's senior year, unable to compete in the second semester, Granby wasn't empty, as Bill Merriam won the state title at 115 pounds. Through his relationships at the NCAA championships, Billy Martin was starting to develop a network of college coaches who were recruiting his wrestlers. By the time Gray Simons was headed to college, two of those former Granby wrestlers had already won NCAA championships. Pete Blair for the United States Naval Academy and Eddie Eichelberger from Lehigh. Matter of fact, Blair never even started at Granby High School. So how does Gray Simons from Norfolk, Virginia, end up at tiny Lock Haven State Teachers College in central Pennsylvania?
Coach Martin took Mike Grandstaff, came over, he worked out with us, but he took a whole four or five guys, Brandon Glover and Bill Corby, some other people, to the National AU Tournament up in Waynesburg, Pennsylvania. So I went up and wrestled that at 114.5. I won a couple of matches and I got bumped out. And then he wanted to go up there because he wanted to talk to the coach from Penn State in Pittsburgh about me going there. And we ran into a guy that had gone to Lock Haven. And we got talking to him and he told us, you know, that Lock Haven had a guy that was an NCAA wrestling champ. They had a good program.
Lock Haven, Pennsylvania was wrestling crazed. Its nickname is still synonymous with the sport of wrestling, Mat Town.
Mat Town's exactly what it says. That's made that town.
This is Jack Day, 1958 high school graduate of Bald Eagle Nittany High School, which sat about 8 miles from Lock Haven's campus. Jack wrestled at Lock Haven from 1958 to 1962, winning an NAIA national championship along the way.
The wrestling made that town. I mean, not only in the college, but the high school. Lock Haven High School, tough wrestling. Bobby Bub came out of there, a lot of good guys, man. They just, and Davy Johnson, it just was an inspiration. And my brother went to Lock Haven. He went there and I went to Baldwin. And it was the year they stopped sending us into Lock Haven. That's when they built Baldwin High School. So we were major rivals right away, and it was just, even in high school, our high schools, they packed the gyms. I remember one year we wrestled Phillipsburg Osceola. They were 34-0, and we were 24-0. And they packed the gym, and the fans from Phillipsburg's, they weren't allowing them in. They said, "We're coming in." They tore the one door off the gym and came in. And the place was packed. And ended up a 20-20 tie. Yeah, Henry Red Campbell was the coach at Phillipsburg Osceola, later went on to coach at Lehigh. And Bob Janis, they both were Lock Haven grads. And Bob Janis was from Lock Haven too, you know, and the rivalry was just incredible. And then we went from there, we went to Lock Haven, and the same thing was happening.
So Lock Haven piqued Gray's interest. The next step was to go check it out.
Coach Martin contacted Coach Jack. Hubert Jack was the Lock Haven coach. Took the bus and went up there and looked at the school and everything. And you could wrestle as a freshman there. I think 800 men. If you had underneath 800 men, freshmen were eligible. Otherwise, big schools like Tech and UVA, if you were a freshman, you couldn't compete on the varsity team. If I went up there, I had a chance to start as a freshman.
Here's Wayne Martin.
I mean, he wanted to really be good. And he was looking for the right school to go to, and Dad was really wanted to make sure that he would get to a place that it had a nurturing coach, and Coach Jack was that, Gray's coach at Lock Haven. It was fairly close, so he wouldn't get homesick. If he had to, he could come home, those types of things. But Gray just wanted to, you know, he was able to internalize holes very good. And I think as he got out of Granby, he got really, you know, went to college. His ability to do that, he was exposed to more collegiate wrestling, obviously. Lock Haven had a pretty good schedule back in those days all along the East Coast, and he was hitting really good competition. And the guys, that you know, he had good workout partners is what I remember at Lock Haven. And that's where he really, you know, really blossomed, you know, collegiately and got really tough because he would come home. I remember Dad telling a story, he'd come home like Christmas time. Those guys would come home for like maybe a week break. And he'd come back into the room where and Grampy, and he'd start showing all the new holds, the new setups that he was using. The basic steps didn't, you know, inside steps, singles, and those didn't change, but it was the technique and the setups, you know, and I think Coach Jack was great at training those guys and really getting it into their system, timing and sequences of holds, you know, which we call chain wrestling now, how to go from one hold to another. And Gray really flourished. I mean, he got really, really good and got a lot of exposure right then.
So over the river and through the woods to Lock Haven State Teachers College, Gray Simons would go. And his living situation was unlike any freshman at the time, or even any time. So how does Gray explain it? Like this.
Coach Jack found a place to live for me. It was a house, half a mile from the school. And there was two ladies there, Mrs. Bittner and Mrs. Ricker. They were sisters in their 70s. So they needed someone to stay at their house and shovel snow off the sidewalks. They had a coal furnace do that. I went in and stayed there all 4 years. It was like living with two grandmas. And that put me in interstate. They changed my tuition from out of state to in state because I was living with Mrs. Bittner and Mrs. Ricker.
So with the opportunity to compete as a freshman, Gray Simons wasn't just handed the spot. As a matter of fact, in that era, dual meets were only 8 weights. Sometimes you'd find tournaments that had 115 and 191. Gray Simons wrestled 115 pounds, which means he had to fight just for a spot to compete in a dual meet in his home gym.
You know, I wrestled off the guy that was at, I could beat the guy that was at 123, and I was at 15. I could beat him. So, I got to wrestle.
So you had to win that spot.
Right, yeah. No, I had to wrestle off the guy.
In 1958 and 1959, Gray Simons took the mat for the Bald Eagles of Lock Haven State Teachers College. In December of his freshman year, he finished third at the Wilkes Open, losing to Syracuse assistant coach Ed Carlin, who eventually lost in the finals to the University of Toledo's Dick Wilson, a 1956 Olympian. 3 weeks later, Gray Simons was in the lineup against Paul Powell, Pittsburgh's 123-pound returning national champion and Lock Haven native. While Powell won the match, it wasn't the triumphant return many had expected. In fact, it was a coming-out party for Gray Simons to the college wrestling world. Here's the match summary from the February 2nd, 1959 edition of Amateur Wrestling News. Pitt beats Lock Haven. Pittsburgh Panthers handed Lock Haven Teachers their first loss of the season as they won a closely contested meet Saturday, January 24th by an 18-16 mark. The contest was much closer than the score indicates. Pitt won the first 6 weights, 4 of them by 1-3 points. Tom Alberts, Pitt's 1957 NCAA champion, won 8-1 for the most one-sided score. But the widest margin of victory was turned in by Kramer of Lock Haven in the 177-pound bout when he bested Vuokuolo 15-6. Paul Powell, Pitt's defending 123-pound NCAA champion, was held to an 8-7 verdict by Simons. What Amateur Wrestling News couldn't know at the time is that would be the last time Gray Simons would not have his hand raised in college competition.
And he was a Lock Haven guy. I mean, he went to Lock Haven High School. And we wrestled Pitt at Lock Haven. Paul Powell, he was a Lock Haven guy. Bob Bubb was a Lock Haven guy. And then 2 upperweights that were Lock Haven guys. They had 4 Lock Haven guys on the Pitt team. And, of course, the place was jam-packed.
For Jack Day, who grew up just miles from campus, he knew this was a special moment.
So I knew Paul. Now, Paul went to Pitt and was national champion out there. And Gray wrestled him his freshman year and only lost to him by 1 point. I knew, this guy is something else.
The February 16th, 1959 cover of Amateur Wrestling News featured a bullet point about Lock Haven beating Northern Illinois. Lock Haven put a stop to the winning streak of Northern Illinois University here February 2nd with a hard-fought 19-10 victory. Other NIU winning streaks were also ended when Gray Simons, Lock Haven, beat Dale Tesler 7-3 for the latter's first loss of the year. Because he wasn't eligible for the NCAA postseason, Gray's name wasn't mentioned in any of the previews for the 1959 NCAA championships. Competitors in the NAIA weren't so lucky. From the April 6, 1959 issue of Amateur Wrestling News, Page 3, Mankato wins NAIA for second year. Mankato State College repeated as NAIA champions in the second annual tournament completed here March 20 through 21st, crowning two individual champions, 3 seconds and 2/3 for a total of 64 points. Only two 1958 champions were present to defend their titles, and both were dethroned. Gray Simons, Lock Haven, unseated Jack Themert, Mankato, in the 115-pound class and was named Outstanding Wrestler of the Meet. On the NCAA side of things, Yale's Andy Fitch beat Toledo's Dick Wilson 3-3-5-4 in overtime to win the title at 115 pounds. Simons' NAIA Championship Finals opponent, Jack Thamert, finished fourth at the NCAA tournament. Common misconception these days is that winning the NAIA tournament qualified you for the NCAA championships. Well, that wasn't the case. Through 1968, the NCAA tournament was open, meaning any team, any athlete, was free to compete. But in situations like at Lock Haven, where finances were often a concern, the NAIA tournament was often a tryout process to see if you could even compete at the NCAA championships.
Well, if you, you know, if you did well there, you would get a chance to go to the NCAAs. That was Coach Jack's decision. And like that first year, Ralph Clark, he was at 147, he won the NAIs. I think Hank Shaw got second. I won. So we had like three or four guys that were, you know, in second place or winners that would go to Maryland for the NCAAs. That was that second year. And then Ralph Clark, I think he got third in the NCAAs my sophomore year. The year I won it, he was third. So we were like in the top 10 teams, you know. NCAAs that year were at Maryland, so that was a... And the NAIAs were at Lock Haven that year.
We again turn to the pages of Amateur Wrestling News for its NCAA preview edition, March 21st, 1960. Individual competition breaks it down like this. After analyzing dual meet and available tournament records, we size up individual competition as follows. 115 pounds, Dick Wilson, Toledo, and Gray Simons, Lock Haven, are the class of the field, provided Wilson elects to enter this class, in which he was runner-up last year. He's been wrestling at 123 and 130 this year and won the Mid-America Conference title at 137. His principal interest is in Olympic wrestling, however, which may affect his collegiate competition. Gray Simons, who has won 22 straight duels, the Wilkes and NAIA tournaments, might beat Wilson at his best. In winning his second NAIA championship, Gray beat Fort Hays State's Dale Vodopka 11-2. He was also named the tournament's outstanding wrestler for the second year in a row. When the time came for the NCAA championships, Gray was seated second. He opened up with a fall over Bob Pierce of Delaware before beating Thamert again 13-6 in the quarterfinals. In the semifinals, it was Dennis Friedrichs of Iowa State who Gray would defeat 5-3 before beating Dick Wilson 3-3-2-2 on a referee's decision to win his first NCAA title and sending Wilson to his second straight championship finals defeat. Here's Gray.
When I wrestled Dick Wilson in the finals my sophomore year at Maryland, he was runner-up from the year before. Plus, he was on the 56 Olympic team, Greco-Roman. He was, you know, he was a man. And I wrestled him. Now Granby rolled him a couple times on the takedown. He never shot a takedown, and I shot like a low ankle shot, a sweep. And I got his foot, and he kicked out, and he got the takedown. At the end of the match, I had to ride him out. I hadn't ridden him hardly at all. I had to ride him out the last 30 seconds, 45 seconds, tied the match up, and then I beat him in the overtime. They voted, and I won the match.
As a collegiate sophomore, coaches Jack and Martin talked Gray into trying to make the 1960 Olympic team. In Jamie Moffitt's book, Wrestlers at the Trials, he explains how the Olympic trials process went in 1960. The National AAU organized three levels of trials that constituted the elimination process for selecting the 8 freestyle and 8 Greco-Roman wrestlers who would represent the U.S. at the Olympics in August. First, in the spring, wrestlers competed in one of 8 regional qualifiers. You had to place first or second to be invited to the final Olympic team trials tournament held in Ames, Iowa. However, those really weren't the final team trials. The Olympic Wrestling Committee declared that a two-week-long final Olympic training camp, or the camp, would take place starting July 22nd on Olympic team coach Port Robertson's hallowed ground, the University of Oklahoma campus in Norman. In winning the regional qualifier, Gray got hurt and was unable to compete in Ames. Gray Simons was one of three wrestlers to receive an exemption and was part of the finals camp in Norman. In his weight class at the camp was his former high school teammate and high school nemesis Mike Grandstaff, Andy Fitch, and Toledo's Dick Wilson.
Well, he was, he, you know, like I say, he was on the 56 Olympic team. He was a man, you know, a very nice guy, good fella. And in 1960, he won the freestyle and Greco both tryouts. And I think Andy Fitch was second. Andy had beaten him in the NCAAs in the finals, an overtime match from Yale. And I had my match with him, and then I had come down to Norfolk to try out. Coach Jack brought me down here for the regional tryouts, and I tore my knee out. My knee got messed up, so I couldn't wrestle, and I couldn't go on to the next. I won the tournament. Somehow I messed my knee up, and I couldn't wrestle anymore. So for that in that spring, so what they did, they invited me to the training camp, and so Wilson was number one, and Fitch was two. And Mike Grandstaff, the guy from Tech, was three. So they invited me. So I beat Grandstaff, and then I beat Fitch. And then Wilson, I didn't wrestle him. He just decided he'd just go Greco. You know, I beat Grandstaff and Fitch, and I made the team.
As a college sophomore with limited freestyle experience, Gray Simons ends up going from not competing at the trials, getting what amounts to be a wild card into the final team camp, and then beats number three and number two to earn a place in the final trials wrestle-off, before that guy goes, "Nah, I'm going to wrestle Greco." And just like that, Gray Simons was on a U.S. Olympic team.
You know, I prepared myself for that, and I worked out Grandstaff. I knew I could beat him. And Fitch, I didn't wrestle him too much in practice because I didn't want him to know what I was doing, you know what I mean? I thought I could do it, and I did it. I contributed a lot of it to my coaches, Bill Martin, the number one high school coach in the country, Hubert Jack. I wasn't his, you know, Gusty Augustine had won the NCAA title. He had other guys at place, so he knew what he was doing. I had great coaches.
Rome, Italy was the spot for the 1960 Olympics, and the freestyle team was set. At 114.5 pounds was Gray Simons. At 125.5, Terry McCann. At 136.5, Lou Gianni. At 147.5 was Shelby Wilson, followed by Doug Bluebaugh at 160.5. 174 pounds was Ed DeWitt, Dan Brand at 191 pounds, and Bill Kerslake at heavyweight. Of those eight men who represented the United States on the men's freestyle Olympic team, seven are in the National Wrestling Hall of Fame as distinguished members.
Going over there, we were in, it took like 15 hours. We were in a propeller airplane. We flew up to Oklahoma to New York. Worked out there at the New York AC, and then flew from New York to, in Ireland, we stopped and got gas, and then flew to Rome. We were there, we trained and worked out, and, you know, we were ready. The coach, Port Robertson, was a good coach. We ran stadium steps, all kinds of running, which I never did much running in high school or college. So that was the hardest part for me, was the running. We'd wrestled two matches back to back. The matches were, I think, 12 minutes long. You know, we were top shape.
The international scoring system used back in 1960 resembles nothing we know of today. It was called the black mark system. Wrestling historian Mike Chapman explains.
Yeah, that's a strange era of wrestling. It basically goes, if you win by pin, you get zero bad marks. If you win by a decision, you get one bad mark, and the person who lost gets three. If you lose, of course, you lose three bad marks, as I just said. If you get pinned, you lose four bad marks, and the guy who pins you gets a zero. If you wrestle to a tie, you both get two black marks. You total six black marks, and you're out of the tournament.
Gray was successful in his first Olympic match. winning by fall over Sweden's Bengt Frönfors at 2:08. In the second round, he drew Turkey's Ahmet Bilek, the 1959 world silver medalist.
You know, I never hollered at my kids when they wrestled because you distract them. I think one of my teammates hollered at me and said, "Get the legs on him." And I thought it was the coach. And I was taking him down and I put the legs on him. And he got my hand and rolled me underneath of him. I was pinned. But I don't think, you know, y'all could have taken him down all day long.
Now with four black marks, Gray Simons' back was against the wall. In round three, he pinned Mexico's Jorge Rosado, a wrestler Dick Wilson had beaten in the 1959 Pan Am Games in Chicago. Round four, the Soviet Union's reigning world champion, Ali Aliyev. That match won by decision by Gray Simons, but giving him one more additional black mark. Gray's Olympic run in Rome ended in round five as he lost by a decision to Masayuki Masaraba of Japan, giving him six black marks and eliminating him from competition. The weight class finished out with Ahmet Bilek, the wrestler who had pinned Gray in the second round, winning gold. Matsuraba finished with the silver, and Iran's Ibrahim Sifpour finished with the bronze. From an American perspective, it was a successful Olympic Games with three wrestlers, Terry McCann, Shelby Wilson, and Doug Blueball, winning gold medals. It was the first time since 1932 that the United States had won three golds in freestyle. Gray Simons' three wins was good enough to put him in fifth. He would head back to Lock Haven State Teachers College with two more years of college wrestling ahead of him. Next time on 7.
Yeah, he was just so slick. He was kind of like the Wayne Gretzky of wrestling. He was like a half second ahead of everybody else he wrestled. He knew where you were going to be like two moves before you knew where you were going to be.
And people would line up in the wintertime, cold outside, line up down the street for hours before the matches because the pace of Thomas Fieldhouse was just packed. It was a real exciting time to wrestle because you would get a takedown or you would score a point, the place erupted, and Gray was the reason for that. They came to see him more than any of us.
I wanted to go there because I only lived a little over an hour away from Lock Haven, and Gray's reputation was larger than life. You know, that was my first choice.
Seven is a presentation of the National Wrestling Hall of Fame in Stillwater, Oklahoma. This episode is written and produced by Jason Bryant. Historical research provided by Amateur Wrestling News, Volumes 4 and 5. Wrestlers at the Trials by James V. Moffitt. The Granby Roll by Johnny Brown. And the National Wrestling Hall of Fame.